Jimmy C. from Tannersville Just for Today group. Right on.
Actually, I kind of like that, to be honest with you. No. All right, everybody, I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. I did kind of like the lights when I walked in. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. That was nice. So, wow, what a great day today. You know, I was thinking on the way down here, you know, one of the things Alcoholics Anonymous has certainly allowed and gifted me to kind of get after a period of time of being around Alcoholics Anonymous was how to really sit in the moments and really enjoy the moments and see the grace in the moments of what's really going on in my life today versus what my life used to be like. And today was a very beautiful day. You know, I got to spend it with my parents who, you know, I do some caretaking with. You know, my father has some dementia and my mother's losing her hearing and she's getting a little, she's not remembering too much. Well, she's remembering, but not well. You know, and to be able to get, you know, not only just be with them every day, but today to get up and go to some other beautiful people's house who welcomed us into their home to share some Christmas dinner with and fellowship and, you know, to have a place to be, to share what this day was really about. You know, knowing that I was going to come here and talk tonight, whatever it is I'm going to talk about, you know, I'm certainly going to talk about alcoholism. I'm going to talk about how cunning, baffling, and powerful it is. It's been in my life. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. And what happens when I'm able to contact and connect with that God and understand that he wants nothing more from me but to be able to really slow down long enough to be in these moments to understand his grace. You know, my life didn't look anything like that before, and it didn't look like that in Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of years even. You know, it took quite a few years to, you know, I had to get enough of me out of the way, sober, to stop things like worrying so much or trying to overachieve or, you know, worrying about developing a purpose and, you know, all those kind of things that we kind of do in life. You know, it was amazing how easy it is to get in Alcoholics Anonymous and get ripping and get running. And, you know, I went from doing absolutely nothing to thinking I had to do absolutely everything. And, I've probably done everything like that went against what Alcoholics Anonymous and God would want me to do while I was here, and learned from that I shouldn't do that anymore, do the things I do today. And I'm not perfect by any means today. But, man, I'm a whole lot better than the way it used to be. You know, I'm a whole lot better. And, I want to thank all you guys for coming out tonight. I mean, God has seen fit that in this moment that we're supposed to share this hour together. You know, I don't take that for granted. That's very special. Whoever's in this room, you know, I'm really grateful that he put us all together here tonight for this hour, so that we can talk about what happens when we do his work, when we rely upon him. You know, Jeff sent something out via text message that I thought was pretty cool. It said that it was about Christmas. It said love and action is what Christmas is about, you know. And it's funny because my sponsor was talking to me a little bit about that also. And, you know, he asked me, he said, Jim, is like, no matter what the day is, does it feel like it's Christmas? Are you loving action? You know, is it every day like Christmas for you? And, you know, I would like to think for the most part it is. There's days where it's probably a little better than other days, you know. But that's nothing like it used to be. It used to be like, I didn't even know what love meant. I had no understanding of it. You know, my understandings of things that I've learned in this program back then, like for instance, would be, my concept of what freedom was. You know, I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would hear people talk about, I want to be set free, I'm set free, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free. And, you know, my concept was if I wasn't in jail, that meant I was free. And I really mean that. Like, for me, I would be in and out of institutions so much that if I wasn't there and people weren't totally running my life and they weren't locking a door and called the shots and when the door opened and when the door closed and all these rules and regulations, if I wasn't in the midst of that, that meant I was experiencing freedom. And I've come to find out through this program that, you know, I was probably in a greater degree a sense of locked up and hostage more with my untreated alcoholism than I was actually in those places, you know. So Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the book Chuck Chamberlain wrote, New Pair of Glasses. Man, this program has really allowed me to put a new pair of glasses on to look at it from an entirely different perspective of what a lot of my perceptions of what life were about, a lot of my perceptions of, you know, I would say with love, you know, that word love, you know, I was probably more in love with the concept of what love is than actually knowing what love is. I would see it in what I thought you would display it to be, and I would think that that meant if I had that I had it. And the reality is I come to find out that it doesn't happen anything like that. Love is my own personal experience that I have in life from learning how to connect with you in action, and being selfless and useful and all those really kind of cool, neat, freeing things that I wasn't when I have this problem that's untreated. You know. So I'm grateful to be here with you guys tonight. I'm really grateful you guys are here. And, you know, basically I'm really here. You know, it says at the end of There Is a Solution in the last paragraph, it says, you know, my job from this podium is basically to describe to you guys through my own experience how I developed this relationship with a power greater than myself. You know, I'm only the messenger. That's all I am. You know, and I'm so glad Mary said something to me a little while ago. I said, hey, would you watch my coat for me? I'm going to set it right there. And Mary said, hey, you know, you're one of those guys that help keep the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous open so that I had a place to come when it was time to get sober. And that's a pretty powerful statement. You know, it really is. It's a pretty powerful statement. And you know what? I don't know if I've ever thanked enough people and told them that, what you told me. That I've ever thanked a lot of people that kept the doors open so I had a place left to go. You know? I couldn't imagine when there was no place else left to go And when I felt like there was no place else left to go, if they once again would direct me to this thing called AA and I would go to the door and there was no door to open or no basement to go into or no cup of coffee to get or no cookie to grab or no somebody at least welcome me in some kind of a way, you know, that I didn't feel like I was going to try to get something taken from me or, I don't know, I don't know what that would be like, man. My life was horrific without the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? And with the people in it who have kept the doors open and have preserved this program for as many years as they have, you know. And I don't know if I, you know, and that's why I need to talk about this, because I think the first part in being become better at doing it is talking about it, is opening my heart up to it, is sharing it with you, is, you know, that I know it and that maybe I need to strive harder to respect it and become help me become even a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous with it, you know? Because I know, you know, I ran around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long, long time. Not looking at Alcoholics Anonymous anything like that, you know? First time I was ever in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was like in 1978. That's a pretty damn long time ago, you know? It's like 2018, you know, it's like, whoa, you know, and I didn't get sober then, you know, I've been separated from alcohol this last time since August the 20th, 1998, and that leaves like a 20-year span of me running in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and You know, I really never really wanted to come here. You know, I never like on any given day kind of said to myself, even when after a while I would put the fact that from everybody else telling me and then me starting to get in places to where I couldn't like ignore it anymore. When I would get to these places where I knew that anytime anything was going on in my life, it wasn't good. Me and alcohol were always in the same place. We had developed this relationship and it wasn't working. It was getting the better of me. Like I just couldn't ignore him, and I knew all that was happening. Even on those days, I never said, hey, well, I think I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous and try to do something about this problem. That's never been in my mindset. Even this last time coming in, it was never in my mindset. You know, from the time I walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting all the way to the time I walked in last time, I always felt like I'd been sentenced to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And literally, I have been a few times. There were judges and parole officers and everybody that said, you know, if you're going to be in the street and you're going to do, you know, you need to do certain things, and one of them is you need to go to AA. You know, so I would walk through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous already resenting the fact that somebody's telling me what to do. They're making me go to a place I really don't want to go. You know, like, you know, all the walls are up. I'm indifferent. You know, just, I really don't want to be one of you guys. You know, I just wanted it to be something else. I didn't want it to be alcoholism, and I didn't want to have a mental health condition. Being honest with you, I didn't like the stigmas that went along with either of them. And there's not a lot of great stories to tell behind them. You know, I've had a lot of titles in life. You know, along the journey, as we do what we do, and we get into the things we get into, and if you live a life to where you're in and out of institutions, you know, you get titles. You know, you have burglar, dealer, car thief. You know, you get a lot of titles along the way. You know what I mean? I always used to have a good story for those titles. You know what I mean? I got all this stuff out of the house. That car was that nice I stole. That girl was that good looking. That money was that fat. You know, alcoholic, mental health, like, it's no place else left to go, man. Like, not a good story attached to it. You know, it was like the bottom of the barrel, and that still want to be bottom of the barrel. And there was another reason too that I really didn't want to be alcoholic. And the other reason I didn't want to be alcoholic was because I didn't want that title, because that meant I would have been like the man I swore I would have never been like, and that was my father. Because my father was alcoholic. He died from alcoholism. And every day I walked around and said, no matter whatever happens in my life, I would never turn out like that man. And I didn't realize it when it was going on, but I realized it today as I was able to do some work in this program and look and track the progressive nature of my problem. Is the more I drank, the more I became like that man. You know. And that didn't sit well with me. You know. You know, I was pretty highly affected by my dad's untreated alcoholism. It is not what makes me alcoholic by any means. I will say that he was a wonderful blaming mechanism for a lot of years of why I did the things I did. If you had the dad I had, you'd have drank too. If he traumatized you like he traumatized me, you'd be doing this too. And he was a wonderful blaming mechanism. Far past the point of when I crossed the line and picked up the reins myself and started driving the horse around, getting the horse to go where I wanted to go, I would still act as though he was steering the horse. He had everything to do with why the horse ran where it ran, you know. And it was crazy because, you know, what I come to find out through this work is that my dad was probably, he was the guy that kind of planted that fear button in me when I didn't know it was a fear button. I had no idea what it was. I didn't know it was fear. I didn't understand feelings. I didn't know anything like that. But I just knew that when I thought of that man, or I seen that man, or I interacted with that man, that things about me would change, man. The way I breathe, you know, just the way I view things, you know, just there was a sense of, always a sense of when's the shoe going to drop again. There was a sense of when's the whole script going to change, because that's what it was like when I lived with my father, when his untreated alcohol, with his untreated alcoholism is, you know, talk about the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You put his picture right next to it. You know, he was the guy in the morning that, you know, he was like that. He'd play with you, he'd wrestle with you, he'd laugh with you, and then all of a sudden that clock would strike a certain time, and all of a sudden you didn't exist. He'd put his jacket on, he'd leave the house. He'd be gone all day most of the night, and all of a sudden that door would fly open, and it'd be fundamentally a different man coming through that doorway. Looked different, sounded different, smelled different, and most certainly acted different. You know, and I can tell you, as a young kid, that kind of really confused me. Some of the things, you know, I would say, I just remember him playing with me this morning. Now you can't even approach him. You got to hide from him. You know, my favorite CP came under the bed, because my dad, well, he was a blackout drinker, but he had a bigger problem than blackout drinking. He had blackout anger. And I had a little mom that used to try to tell him about his drinking when he would come home drunk. And, you know, it would take but about 2 or 3 minutes, and the house would go into shambles, and I would run through the bedroom and get under the bed. And I remember plain as day laying under that bed at the edge trying to hear what was going on, like frozen solid, like, you know. And every once in a while, when he didn't come out of it right away, he'd come into the bedroom and he'd snatch me out, and I'd become a part of the scenery. And man, I'll tell you what, you know, I just can remember walking around through life as a kid, always waiting for that shoe to drop, always waiting for things to get unpredictable, never really feeling comfortable, like I could relax and take a deep breath. You know, head was always on a spindle, what's next kind of a thing. You know, and you know, I just remember one day I took drink, and I don't know, drink took me, it did for me what I couldn't do for myself, whatever you want to say, but all of a sudden that stuff didn't completely go away, but it melted into a place which was much more satisfactory than what I was experiencing before I took that drink. And it became a wonderful focal point of making sure I tried to have it in my life every day. Because I don't know if it was so much I would get a sense of ease and comfort about getting drunk as much as I would get a sense of ease and comfort about not feeling that old way anymore, or worried in that old way anymore, or feeling like I was totally immobilized or couldn't breathe like that old way anymore. And for me, I really believe that's the time when, you know, alcohol became a solution in my life. You know, it began to solve something. I perceived me to believe something. I could solve something that I couldn't solve without. You know, so you bet I chased it like a full-time job with unlimited overtime. You know, and, you know, I would pay the prices right away as a kid. You know, it changed who I was as a kid. Even though I was afraid and I was waiting for the shoe to drop, and I would go through the normal everyday functions of life, go to school, you know, try to be a part of life, even though it was tough to fit in. And you know, I'd picked up such negative skills behind my dad's untreated alcoholism. Like, for instance, you know, I would always walk around, I'd be comparing my insides with your outsides. You know, I would walk in, never felt worthy, didn't feel like a part of the crowd. Always felt like, you know, if you knew my story, none of you would want to be friends with me. You know, I started to pick up some mechanisms of how to maybe make myself feel more comfortable, as though you wouldn't see it right away. Like, I would begin to tell stories and lie, and you know, you guys would be like, yeah, me and my dad did this. I'd be like, oh yeah, me and my dad did that too. And you know, I would develop these mechanisms of reaction to not let you really truly see what was going on in my life, and how, not so much how I felt, because I really didn't know how I feel, but maybe that I was like really unsure about all of it. I just never wanted you to let you see how unsure I was about everything. Because I really thought that you wouldn't like me. You know? And, you know, when I picked that drink up and it did for me what I couldn't do for myself. All that stuff just seemed so much less important, you know. Really didn't seem to be the focal point, you know, and it allowed my spirit to come out and play. You know, it allowed me to have conversations with people I would normally have. It would allow me that not to have that worry of what you thought, you know. It would even spin my psyche up enough to get a little cocky with it and sometimes think that you're pretty damn lucky to even be hanging out with me. You know what I mean? And my stories, like, I would be lying just to set the pace to be like the Joneses. But now I would start to one-up you with lies. Like, now I did something you didn't do. You know what I mean? Like, I was taking this stuff to places that were absolutely going to set my life up for a life of torture and suffering. And I had no idea that was happening. You know, and I would begin to pay the prices early in life, you know, with things like, you know, one thing that when I was a kid was I was an excellent athlete. I hid in sports. That was the place where I didn't feel like I needed to take drink to feel okay in, because I was pretty good at it. I felt like I was already with the Joneses. Sometimes people would compliment me that I was actually a little better than most, and I felt this is a great place to be, man. I can be in the middle of playing football or baseball or basketball, and I could just be me and it would be okay. You know what I mean? But one of the sad things about that is, you know, one day practice is over. The game is over. It gets dark out. It's time to go home. And that phase of that life kind of gets put away for that day, and I got to go back to the life of reality of this is the way I live. So I guess it's safe to say when I talk to you about my dad being that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I was the Jekyll and Hyde long before I ever picked up drink, of how I was living my life. What it was like when I lived in athletics, what it was like when the game was over, when the horn blew, when it was time to go home, I would become that other person. You know, I like in our third step when they talk about the director wanting to run the whole show, various traits, you know. Man, I was doing that long before I picked up drink. I was playing that game. I was trying to arrange everything and direct everything so I could keep myself somewhat safe and protected, and long before I picked up a drink, you know, long before. And I had no idea, you know. What's crazy is I was really able to see, after doing the work in this program, how affected my mother was by my dad's untreated alcoholism and how she would raise me in life moving forward. You know, and she did the best she could with what she had. And she loved me the best she can. She taught me right from wrong. She loved me. She went to great lengths. I mean, I've been locked up in a lot of jails all over the place. And regardless of where I've been locked up, that woman would get in a car and drive how many hours to walk into a place and sometimes sit across from a plate glass and pick up a phone and say, I just came to tell you that I love you and I hope things can be different. Care what it was. You know, and I can remember before I started going to jail, before they had to give me tough love and they eventually had to put me out of their house. I remember she would stay there and she would grab me and she would shake me like she was going to shake me sober, shake me clean. I mean, like, why don't you just stop? You know, if you go to jail, I'm never coming to visit you. The threats we get. You know what I mean? But when it hit the fan, she was there every time. I love you. Please, what can we help you with? You know, just the one person that would go to any length to not give up on me. You know. You know, and it's crazy because I could see none of it when it was going on. I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous feeling like I was sentenced to be here. And still hadn't hit that total place of hopeless state of mind and body, and was totally out of plan and ideas. I could be running in an Alcoholics Anonymous a few times before that happened, and in the midst of being surrounded by all you people and you sharing your experience, strength, and hope, and maybe even talking about the stuff that I was talking about, I did not hear it and I did not see it like I do today, being able to share it with you, sitting dead smack in the middle of what I'm sitting in the middle of now. And I know a lot of that has to do with what it felt like walking through the doors when I felt like I was sentenced to be here. Because I can tell you, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I feel like I'm sentenced to be here, I come in here, I'm not even looking at solving the right problem. I'm already attempting to solve the wrong problem. And if I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous trying to solve the right problem, I don't stay in that chair too long. And if I do stay in that chair for a period of time, there's a motivator behind me that's making me stay in that chair. It's a power greater than me. And it's not the one we talk about in this program. It's usually called a state parole officer. He'll motivate me to stay in that chair. Because I've experienced jail. I don't want to go back there. So I'm going to play the game and sit in that chair and try to honor that power. Because I know he's got the power. But you know what? Just like anything else, when that power leaves my life, you know, there's Jim. You know, so I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I felt like I was sentenced to be here and I would come in here trying to solve the wrong problem because, you know, I always thought one of the things I was never taught, never shown, and from my dad's untreated alcoholism, never wanted to do was turn the microscope inward and see what was really going on with Jim. Problems were always, everything was always out here, which meant if I thought it was always out here, what needed to be fixed was always out here. So I would come here and the problem would be, the way my family's treating me, my kids, it would be, the job I should have had that I don't have, it would be the girlfriend, you know. I would have all these things that I would bring into my life, looking to create some manageability, living by self-propulsion, right? And sometimes I would get them in my life just like I wanted them to, and then I would get them and wouldn't know what to do with them. Right? Because if it's one thing I don't know how to do with my untreated alcoholism, I don't know how to take care of anything. Right? I'm so focused selfishly on getting it that once that occurs, I think I have it, and it's like happily ever after. And I don't stare, and once I have it, that's when the real work begins. You know? Because I can tell you my experience is when I put down drink, just put it down, or it gets taken from me, and I have to go without it for a while, my life gets better. Pieces of my life get better. I get my weight up, I get some color back in my face, I become an employee, I get employable, I get some money in my pocket, I can get a car, I can get things without taking a drink. But then what? But then what? What happens is that I burn them to the ground. I give them away. Because I don't know how to cherish them. I don't know how to value them. I don't know how to be grateful for them. I don't know how to be unselfish with them. I don't know how to really truly love them. I don't know how to do the things with these things that Alcoholics Anonymous really asked me to do in my personal life in relation to you and the world around me. I don't know how to do any of it. So it's just stuff. But for me, it's the stuff that I think makes my world either great or terrible. And for me, it's black or white, do or die, have or not have. And for a guy like me, that's a real dangerous place to be because when I don't have, I go out and do things to get that are not sociably acceptable. I am not a guy that follows the law when I don't have things. Okay. When I go and get things, it's because I'm taking them from somebody. And when I'm taking them, if kindness doesn't work, then we have to pass kindness. We need to go to other levels of getting what I want. You know, and that involves, you know, that involves a lot of hurting people and hurting things. And you know, I become this individual that I think somewhere deep down inside I really don't want to be, but I can't stop from being it because I know no other way. You know, and I would go in and out of jails, and I would run in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would come in here, and I would drink your coffee, I would eat your cookies, I certainly would attempt to date all your girls, because I'm looking for hostages, I need victims, I need to convince somebody that I really care about them, because I really want you to help take care of my life, or polish it up a little better than it is, or I can get something from you I want, you know what I mean, like, that's what it's really all about. And I'm running amok in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys realize who I am. You guys realize who I am. And one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is you keep your door open. You still let me take the chair. You love me still. You tell me keep coming back. Some of you are even courageous enough to stop me and try to tell me the truth about myself. Some of you care long enough that you'd rather kick dirt on my feet than dirt on my grave and say, dude, can I talk to you for a minute? Man, I don't know what you're doing here in AA, but you are going to hurt yourself. You know, and I'll do to you what I do with everybody else. Tell you to mind your own business. Tell you to leave me alone. I'll avoid you. I'll find out what meetings you're going to. I'll go to different ones. I'll do whatever I got to do to keep it moving. Because I'm not, if I'm in here trying to solve the wrong problem, I'm certainly not here trying to listen to anything you really have to say. Especially when it comes to arming with information about the truth about myself. So game on. I'm in the thing that's going to save my life, and I'm treating it like a game, like it's a game. You know? I mean, my problem has never been stopping. My problem has always been staying stopped. I've stopped a ton of times, forcefully, unforcefully, and parole officers. Jim, you drink, you're going back to jail. Okay, I'm done. Right? You know, but when all those ties get taken off and I get a little free will back, I can't stay stopped. You know, the last time was a proven fact. I mean, I was here for about 10 years without taking a drink. I was playing the game with this parole officer, like, you know, I was going to do what I, like, because I knew this cat, he was going to put me in jail, he was going to take all my street time. He told me directly when he came to my house when I got out of penitentiary, he looked me in the face and said, Jim, if you make me do my job, I will, and you're not going to like how I do it. My suggestion is that you do what you got to do and stay away from that, because otherwise, you're going. It's a promise. Right from the door, I was like, okay, I need to acknowledge that. I can't be playing with this guy. Right? And I listened to what, kind of like what he had to say about making sure I didn't drink and I didn't drug and I didn't commit any crimes and I didn't violate the rules of that probation and parole stuff, right? That parole stuff, right? But guess what? He showed up at my door one day after about 8.5 years with a set of papers and looked at me and said, I can't believe it. And I'm like, what? He goes, I can't believe it. You made it and didn't violate. He said, I thought for sure I was going to be putting you back in jail and giving you all your street time. And, you know me, oh, yeah, I'm good. You know, yeah, oh, yeah, I showed you, right? Right. And he leaves my life, and just like he leaves my life, I leave Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? Because I don't really think that I really need to come here anymore. I was really only coming here for that. You know? 8.5 years, I still haven't looked at the fact that, you know, it's my drinking and my thinking, right? I'm clueless. After being here as long as I was, I'm clueless. And I'm going through using the Band-Aids. I like to call them the Band-Aids of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is just me, I feel has a lot of wonderful Band-Aids. You know what I mean? The Band-Aids of going to a meeting every day. The Band-Aids of getting a coffee commitment, the Band-Aids of chairing a meeting, the Band-Aids of maybe being a little service and setting the meeting up, the Band-Aids of maybe run around, pick a couple guys up, take to a meeting. I mean, all wonderful Band-Aids, right? I come in here with an amputation. Band-Aids don't fix amputations, right? The only thing that fixes my amputation is 12 steps. So I'm only in that. I can only be in AA for so long using these Band-Aids before they're falling off and I'm not healing. Right? You know, and eventually, you know, he walks out of my life. I walk away from Alcoholics Anonymous and, wow, it's crazy what the ego will do. It is crazy what the ego will begin to talk to you and say why I have an inside that's total fear and panic because I know I can't pull the job off. I have a head that has an ego that will justify that I'm going to prove to not only myself but prove all to you that I can do this without your help. You know? And I would walk away from AA and you would try to contact me and you would ask me why I'm not going to meetings and all that stuff. And, you know, I would, you know, the best was, people hear me share this all the time, I had a supermarket down the street from my house. It seemed like when I left AA, AA bought that supermarket. Every time I would go in there, everybody from AA would be in it. Now, I haven't even used yet, right? And I would walk in that supermarket and look, and I'd see somebody from AA, and the first thing I'd do when I seen them is I would turn right, I'd duck, and I'd run all the way to the other end of the store. Because I don't want to see you. Because you guys always ask those really hard questions. Those two really hard questions. How you doing and where you been? The ones that I absolutely had to lie about. I'm doing good. I've been busy. Right? Could have copyrighted those answers. Right? And then you would say that third thing to me that would make me want to punch you. You'd be like, and you look at me like right in the eyes, man. I would hate it. And I could tell it would be coming from your heart. And I think I hated that even more because I realized how disconnected I was from mine. And you would look at me with this care and concern and love, and you would say, why don't you give me a call? I'll take you to a meeting. I'd be like, oh. And my ego would go, prove to him that you don't need to do that. Prove to them that you don't need them. You know, so all of a sudden I find a bigger way to have a problem with Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it. And I can't get back to you. And my life is spiraling downward because who I am drastically changes. The way I see things, the way I perceive things, the way I hear things, the way I communicate with people. You know, everything about me changes. The old me comes to surface. The only thing that hasn't happened is I just haven't physically picked the drink up yet. Right? And I'm suffering. And I'm suffering hard. And I'm grabbing things out here to try to put them in my life to crush that feeling that it isn't happening and none of it's working. No matter what I grab, nobody's filling that. None of it's filling that hole in that soul. None of it, none of it, none of it. And I can't walk back into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and raise my hand and say, hi, my name's Jim and I'm an alcoholic. And I walked away from AA a year and a half ago. And you know what? My life is in pure chaos without a drink, even worse than what I used to drink. And I am hopeless. My ego would not let me walk into a meeting and do that. You know, so eventually, me and a drink ran into each other. And it won. And I drank. And much like every other time from the past, my pattern of what happens when I pick up drink happened. And for me, you know, the drink bone's connected to the drug bone. We'll leave it at that. You know, for me, alcohol gives me permission to come out and play and do all those other things. And then I'll start to tell myself in my mind that alcohol can't really take me where I want to go. I think I need to explore much into further things besides alcohol. But alcohol is always present through all of it. And you know, when I think about the progressive nature of when I picked that drink up and how it progressively got worse. And some of the things I was doing with people that really cared about me, you know, and I would begin to avoid my family. You know, I spent 8.5 years when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, really trying not to do the right thing, but I wasn't drinking. I would still be able to be present for my family. Once I walk away from AA and I'm starting to get hopeless and this, that, and the other, I'm staying away from my family a little more. And I see they're looking at me differently. And you know what? This thing's really starting to work me from the inside out. You know, and I'm suffering on the inside. You know, and I'm trying to show you that I'm not suffering. You know. And all of a sudden, you know, like, I feel like my employer's taking advantage of me. I feel like the girl I have isn't good enough. You know, I need a better one. And, you know, nothing's ever enough. No matter what I'm doing, it needs to be more. It needs to be different. You know what I mean? And no matter what I'm doing, none of it is giving me a sense of ease and comfort. And I do what I do when I interface or drink because I don't have the power to not drink. And I drink. And it takes me exactly where it always takes me, you know. That physical craving pops in, that mental obsession pops in, it becomes a full-time job with unlimited overtime, and everybody that cares me needs to exit my life, and everybody who does things like I do, I bring in and call them my best friends, and I love them, and we're brothers from another mother and all that stuff, and we're killing each other too, and no matter where I go, there I am, and it's hopeless. But on top of hopeless, I'm starting to feel real helpless. You know, and my mind's becoming homicidal and suicidal. You know, and I wind up in another jail cell. Thank God. I wind up in another jail cell. And I got in that jail cell, and things were a little different when I got in that jail cell because, you know, I sat in that jail cell and, man, there was something in my gut. There was just something in my gut that was like, you know what, Jim? You're done, man. This is it, man. You just can't do that anymore. Just like really game over, man. Like, I was in a place in my gut in that hopeless state of mind and body, and I was desperate, and those planets started to interlock, and I was feeling a lot of fear, but it was a different kind of fear. It wasn't an immobilizing fear. It was more of a mobilizing kind of fear that, if I can get another shot of some kind, man, I'm afraid not to take advantage of it and do whatever has to happen for me to take care of what I need to take care of, which was new for me. Fear would never be a mobilizing fear. It would always be an immobilizing fear for me, and that was a little different. And those planets kind of interlocked, and I remember the jail I went to, the first 28 days is like 23-hour lockup, and then they put you on another block, and they let you do some things in the jail, and one of the things they let you do is they let you go to meetings. So the first day I get on this new block, there's an AA meeting coming to the jail, and I figured, I'll go to this meeting. So I get down to the meeting, and I walk in the meeting, and I look in the front of the room, and who's chairing the meeting? But a guy that I used to sponsor from the first time and was in the program almost at 10 years. And you want to talk about some humiliation? And he seen me, and he was, like, really surprised to see me, man. And he walked up to me, and he gave me a big hug, and he kissed me on the cheek, and he whispered some real powerful words to me. And the words he whispered were, I'm really glad to see that God has decided to sit you down and have another talk with you. That was cool. Right? Kind of punched right between the eyes. You know, and I can guarantee you for that first 28 days in that jail, when I would lay in that cell at night and I would think I was either in the victim role or the self-pity role of where my life was being in that jail. I can't believe this happened to me again, blah, blah, blah. You know, if it wasn't for these people, I wouldn't be here. And, you know, purely victim self-pity, you know, get them both going at the same time. But when that guy said those words to me that night I went to my cell and I sat and I thought, and out of the middle of nowhere, this thought came. And the thought was, you know what, Jim, this isn't happening to you. This is happening for you. You are sitting dead square in the beginning of the miracle. Because sometimes the beginning of the miracle isn't pleasurable. Sometimes the beginning of the miracle is being stripped naked of everything. No place else left to go but to beg to something that's not tangible. To kind of take those old plans and ideas that you would stick in front of every truth that was real, and now you don't have any more plans and ideas, so you need to see what's true and real. And that's kind of like where I was at, man. I was like, hey, man, this is a whole lot more to work with than what I was thinking this last 28 days. You know, and that mustard seed of hope got planted. And I haven't looked back since. And, you know, from that jail, I would go to a rehab. From that rehab, I would go to a halfway house. From that halfway house, I would go into sober living for 4 years, which meant that ate up about probably 5 or 5.5 years of the first 19 plus years sober. I'm sober right now. And I'm here to report to you that I can directly see with clarity how God has handed me off from not only place to place, but person to person. That has played a major influence of what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And what it's like to sit in the middle of a 12-step fellowship and take 12 steps versus what I used to do, and that's sit in the middle of 12-step fellowship and not take 12 steps. and to show me and get me to understand the value of having that seat in Alcoholics Anonymous and the value of keeping that seat in Alcoholics Anonymous and the value I'm supposed to have for the new guy that walks into the meeting and is going to take the seat up of Alcoholics Anonymous. Kind of back to the reflection of the statement you made. Keeping the doors open for the next guy to come in. Am I a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or am I in here taken? You know, do I come to AA because it's about what I can take from Alcoholics Anonymous, or do I come through the doors because it's what I can give to Alcoholics Anonymous? Where I'm at in my relationship with the power greater than myself. Because I tell you, when I first came to AA, even this last time when I first came to AA, man, I was still coming in, I was throwing up all over meetings, taking them hostage. You know, I used to love open, disgusting meetings, I mean, discussion meetings. I've been honest with you. You know, and thank God for sponsorship, because one of the key things that happened this last time I came around was, not only did I get a sponsor, but I became sponsorable. Because there's a big difference between just having a sponsor and being sponsorable. We read a set-aside prayer, but set aside everything I think I know so that I can begin to have a new experience, and that is firing myself as manager and letting someone else begin to direct my life at 38 years of age. It's humbling. You would like to think, and as a normal human being, at 38, you should have a little something going on, Jim, right? That you can figure a little something out. Well, guess what? At 38, this cat had nothing going on and couldn't figure nothing out. And the best move I could have made was saying, I don't know nothing. Will you please show me? Because I'm doing a horrible job at showing myself. You know. And having a sponsor really teaching me about some of the essence of what that first step was really about. You know, you start talking to me, really start talking to me about, you know, the importance of that second word and that first step, that admitted word, that drawing a conclusion, a final fact, you know. And that I couldn't do it by myself. I needed to honor that first word and our first step. And that is, if I really want to come to terms with that, I have to do that with you, not with myself. You guys help me confirm and set the foundation for that final conclusion of, I'm with this program. I'm this guy this program's talking about. I'm the real alcoholic. See, because what happened, I would run around AA being the real alcoholic, acting like the problem drinker. Right? Couldn't figure out why, when alcohol would get removed, why my problems weren't solved. Because I'm not the problem drinker. That's why. My problem isn't my drinking. My problem is my thinking. I get real squirrely and I get real crazy without drink because I don't know how to do life sober. I don't handle life sober real well. My skin gets too tight. I don't have a real good voice of reason. I get panic thought processes. My fear jumps in. I'm worried. There's fear they talk about in her book. I'm either afraid I'm not going to get something that I want, or I'm afraid that I'm going to lose something that I think I really have. I have no concept that none of it's even mine to begin with, to have or lose. Right? And I'm off on some journey trying to solve the wrong problems again. So I need sponsorship to help me keep me focused in the second word, and what my problem is, what I'm powerless over, is my thinking sober. How I react to things, and that if I don't create that right paradox, then instead of always creating unmanageability, then maybe if I recorrect that paradox, I can create manageability. See, I always thought, you know, I always thought the more I attempted to take control, the more control I would have. But I come to find out the more I attempt to take control, the less control I wind up with. So I had to find out that if I give up control, I can get a sense of control back in the right kind of way to do the right kind of thing with it. I need a sponsor to show me these paradoxes. I can't see them with myself, by myself. You know, and I come to find out once I begin to practice that, and I can kind of see that it works a lot better than anything I've ever come up with, I can start to get slid into what our second step is about. And that's my old belief system and development of a new belief system. And am I really willing to realign that willingness? You know, and it's crazy because I would be in meetings, and I even did this. I would hear people talk about willingness as the lowest on a scale of 1 to 10. They'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm like a 9 today. I'm really willing. And another guy would be, oh, I'm not very willing. I'm like a 2 or a 3. Or, you know what I mean? Like, and it was like from day to day, it would be on this scale. And what I've come to find out is, for me, is that, listen, I serve such a loving, forgiving God that he doesn't even care what I did yesterday. When I get up today, he said, Jim, here's 100% willingness. I've forgiven you for what you did yesterday. I'm giving you an honest shot of trying to get to me. Here's 100% willingness. What are you willing to do with that? Where do you want to align that willingness? Do you want to start to create some restoration and sanity and start to step in towards connecting with me and see how I can provide a much better life than you'd ever been able to when you align your willingness with self? And I become too afraid to do it the old way, and I start to do it the other way. And when I start to do it the other way, I start to have some better outcomes than anything I've ever come up with myself. And it kind of slides me into a third step, you know? And we read about that director and everything and all that stuff. And then I go over to the next page and we read about this newfound life I could have right before third step prayer and, you know, and all this stuff. And I get on my knees and say my third step prayer. And I get up and I look at my sponsor and he's smiling at me. And I don't understand why he's smiling. And I go, what are you smiling for? He goes, well, I just want to let you know your relationship with this power is no greater than it was before you got on your knees. I said, well, what did I get on my knees for? He said, you got on your knees because you humbly are becoming willing to take the job to do the work so that you can understand what that relationship and connect with that thing so you know what it's supposed to be like. And now we need to do some writing. And he takes me into the book where it talks about being launched into a course of vigorous action. And then he takes me to the next sentence, vital and crucial in the same sentence. He said, they're trying to tell you something here, Jim. Vigorous, vital, crucial. If not, little to no permanent effect can happen. And he said, doesn't that remind you of the difference between stopping and staying stopped? Right? And it made sense. And I've always been looking to be in here for something to make sense to me. Because I would hear you guys talk about a lot of different things in your experiences in life. And I wanted it sometimes. And I may have even been a little bit attracted to it. But you know what? I came from a place that even though it was working for you, I never thought it would really work for me, nor did I never really wanted it to work for me. But I was in a place where that changed. So, you know, basically I write this four step out of fear. I'm afraid not to write it. Why am I afraid not to write it? Because I know what happened when I haven't written it before and how many times I've ran in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and what my experiences have been like. And I go, well, I know this is what happens when you don't do it, Jim. So just be too scared not to do it and do it. So I write. And I write the best I can. And my sponsor tells me, it's a reporting step. Keep it simple, Jim. Keep it simple. It's just so when we get a fifth step, we can expand upon it. You know? You write it down. I'll be the fact finder. You be the fact facer. I'll get you to look at it from an entirely different angle. I'll arm you with some important information about yourself. By the time we come out of it, we'll have an understanding of everything we went over. So I write this thing out of fear, and we go through it, and I walk out of it, and I realize something. First time I even realized this in my life. I walked out of a fifth step, and I realized I lost my two best friends. Two best friends I didn't even know I had, and two best friends that I didn't even know I lost. One was the great I, the other was the poor me. I was no longer the legend in my own mind, and I was no longer the victim to anything that happened in my life. So I come out of that fifth step with some value, and my sponsor talks to me about six and seven. He starts talking to me about Jim. They don't call them the forgotten steps by accident. Okay? And he takes me into 12 and 12, and he kind of shows me. He says, God will give you desires every day that you're meant to have. The ability to share, the ability to love, the ability to be loved, to be secure. He wants you to have these desires. What he doesn't want you to do, Jim, is he doesn't want you to blindly use them for self-satisfaction or to ask them to give you more than it's due you. Because if you do, that's the degree by which they'll become a sin or a defect of character in your life. And I get it. And I get it. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I really have to implement in my life every day because I come from a place where I seek. I'm a seeker. For a long time, it hasn't been good things. But I have the desire to seek. Am I willing to align that willingness with the right kind of seeking? Right. And we get into that list and, you know, and we get into that ninth step. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I'd rather take my phone out and say, yo, bro, my bad. Right. And he starts talking to me about the value of direct amends and how it right-sizes not only that relationship, but right-sizes my actions in the world around me with maybe never continuing that behavior again. You know. And I come out of that ninth step and I'm feeling a lot different. And I'm seeing things a lot different. And I'm seeing the value of why I have to chair in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. You know, and we're talking about 10 and 11, which I come to find that for me is really about discipline. You know? You know, I can get sober and run through everyday life and put that out on the back burner in a second. Spot check inventory through the course of the day, or really sitting down with self and asking myself those hard questions about what my day looks like and making sure I clear things up so that I can get into a proper step 11 and really maybe unblock the fact that I can get into what his knowledge of his will for me really is. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I get a laziness program, the devil shows up in God's clothing. And he whispers to me. And he tells me everything's cool and it's all good. And he whispers to me and I look and it's like, man, it's a nice outfit. And like, I start to believe myself, man. About stuff that really isn't what the knowledge of God's will for me is. And for me, I always usually chase, when I'm way off, I chase romances and finances. That's what I chase. When I'm really not chasing that so much, it usually can show up in a form of procrastination or get a little lazy or something like that. But I know that about myself today. You know, and if I could work on that, I can get into what I was taught from the door about being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous is about, and that's our 12 step. Right, to just get up here and try to carry the message through my experience of this is what I've been through. This has been my ups. This is about my downs. This is what absolutely hasn't worked. This is something I found some benefit in my life. This is what I feel has gotten me closer to a God of this understanding that every day I wake up and try to understand a little more. I don't understand God. I don't think I'll ever understand God. But I do know that every day I need to wake up and I need to seek a better understanding of how to do his work and what his will for me is. And if I'm able to do that, then I'm able to sit down with other individuals and have something to transmit to them about what it's like to be in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what these steps can mean in their life through my experience and what it's like to want to keep the chair be of value and what it's like to help keep the doors open as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for the new person that walks in the door. Because guess what? Without the new guy, my life's gone. I need you new guys, man. I need to be talking to you. You know, I need to be working with you. You know, the grand dynamic of one alcoholic helping another. So, thanks for coming out for Christmas, guys. I appreciate it.
We've had a tradition at this meeting of reading a letter that Bill Wilson had written in 1944. AA was 5 years old at the time. And there was a lot going on in the world, a lot of tragedy in other places. And so I've always loved this letter that he wrote, and it's become kind of a tradition here to read it. So I'll let Rich come up and read the letter.
I thought you were just going to read it.
No.
My name's Rich. I'm an alcoholic. I like the little story that goes with it. It's all about me, right? Merry Christmas, everybody. I was at a meeting one time, and they had a little table set out with all the literature and stuff, and I picked up this letter and I read it and it made me cry. I was like, and I thought I had discovered some long lost archive of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I asked the guy who was standing there if I could take it. He said, yeah, take it. So I took it home and I called my buddy Backpack Brian. I'm like, oh my God, you wouldn't believe this letter I found. It's freaking awesome. I told him about it. He goes, Rich, you can get that online. Anyway, my ego was crushed yet again. As Jeff had explained, it's just a letter that Bill Wilson wrote to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1944. We were in the middle of the Second World War, I do believe. It goes like this to all members. Greeting on our 10th Christmas, 1944. Yes, it's in the air. The spirit of Christmas once more warms this poor, distraught world. Over the whole globe, millions are looking forward to that one day when strife can be forgotten, when it will be remembered that all human beings, even the least, are loved by God, when men will hope for the coming of the Prince of Peace as they never hoped before. But there is another world which is not poor, neither is it distraught. It is the world of Alcoholics Anonymous, where thousands dwell happily and secure. Secure because each of us, in his own way, knows a greater power who is love, who is just, and who can be trusted. Nor can men and women of AA ever forget that only through suffering did they find enough humility to enter the portals of this new world. How privileged we are to understand so well the divine paradox that strength rises from weakness, that humiliation goes before resurrection, that pain is not only the price, but the very touchstone of spiritual rebirth. Knowing its full worth and purpose, we can no longer fear adversity. We have found prosperity where there was poverty. Peace and joy have sprung out of the very midst of chaos. Great indeed are blessings. And so, Merry Christmas to you all, from the trustees, from Bobby, from Lois, and myself, Bill Wilson. Thanks for letting me read that. Thank you.